and her sisters. You say she was the youngest sister, wasn't she?
She's the youngest.
Yes. Yes. They were all in the movement,
yes.
Were they? I see, yes.
But they weren't vigorously in it. I think her mother must have been very interested. Now she's alone. And I can't think of the name of the place where she is. I'm always forgetting names. But at any rate, I said, why did you go there? She's in a lovely flat. I said, why did you come here? Well, she said, I had a great friend here that, you know, I felt I could be with, but she died. So she's very, very alone.
Dear. It might be nice to, I'm sure she'd like to hear from you as well as possibly talking to somebody else. I mean, it's for you to say. But that would be a great help, you know.
but I was thinking if anybody could get it, I think you would.
Yes. You say that they were Irish in their background. I mean,
I don't know what her name was before. What her name was before he. She,
yes. You know, did her father support the movement as well?
I never heard much about the father. I don't know when he died. He didn't come into the picture at all.
I see.
But the mother came in, who was a graduate, I think.
Yes.
And then the sisters, and I didn't really know the sisters particularly well. I knew the mother better, but I was always with her. We were about the same age.
Yes, yes. Were there many graduates in the WSBU when you were in it? Because Christabel was a graduate, of course,
yes, she
wasn't
was.
She? Were there many others, do you think?
Well, of course, Maud Yerkin was. A great many were people like me who had no education sort of at all.
Was Christabel keen to get graduates, do you think, in the WSBU?
Well, I think she decided that it was a thing to do. And of course she was following in her father's footsteps.
Yes, yes. Of course she would have had an academic career, wouldn't she, if she'd not been diverted.
She wasn't made out for camp academic career. She was made out for what she did, honestly.
But she was all sort of moving towards an academic career until...
Well, in a way she was, because all her things were actually... almost lost interest in organisation and went only for talking all the time.
Did you say you saw her in her last year or so in America? Did you go to live with her or just visit her or what?
No, she had a we were about she was in Hollywood and I was in Ventura at the time. We saw a lot of each other, but later on she always wanted to come to Santa Monica was the one place she wanted to be in. It's a very nice place, Santa Monica. At any rate, she found a place on the front where she wanted to be, but it wasn't really a very satisfactory place for her, and she was determined to get a certain place, and she got it in the end. She was there for several years, and set my gardener down and I furnished the place for her, and she was very handy. She liked doing things. She took a lot of old furniture and painted it all, and she was very happy there indeed. I think she needed to sort of mess around, you know, and just be able to see people when she wanted to, and you know, go
do
out
what
to lunch
she liked.
With people, do what she liked, and tea with somebody else and so on. And she was very well situated. I wasn't worried about her because there were people around her there that all seemed to dote on her and were always ready to do things for her. And then I used to arrange things for her.
When did she write Unshackled? Do you know? I mean,
she wrote Unshackled about 'Well, she was starting to write it, and I was in England, and she had all my books to do it with. She did it from the Votes of Women and the Suffragette. That was must have been about 'When she began. She must have left off again, then started again. I think she started a bit before we went to America, but I don't think she got very far. And then I think actually we were over in 35. I think she'd written quite a lot of it then. She sent some of it over to me. And she got a publisher. She always seemed to be able to get a publisher. She had a publisher and that thing. And then Sylvia brought out that book about her mother. And she withdrew hers. Only nobody knows that, I don't think. I think that's quite personal, I'm telling you.
You mean Christabel withdrew her own book?
She withdrew her own book. Was she?
Yes.
Because it would have clashed and
yes.
Wouldn't have done. She never. Then 20 years must have gone by, and we all wanted her to. When the Fulford book came out, we felt, some of us felt very strongly that her book should come out, but she didn't want to do it. But I took all her the letters. There were some very interesting letters written, and in this group of letters, every one of them had asked her to get it out and said it was the thing to do. So I got it out.
After she
it was rather left in my hands to do.
Mm. But
I tell you one thing. I think she was tired of the fighting that goes on and the, you know, the criticism that she had to stand up against. And I think she thought she was finished and she wasn't going to do any more.
Did she read Sylvia's biography of her mother? Do you know?
I think she did. I think some things hurt her very much.
Did they?
Mm. Of course, I think that the way she wrote, Sylvia wrote about her mother is dreadful.
Is it? I can't remember the book. I've read it, but it's some time ago.
She said she wasn't any good as a speaker. I don't know. I haven't read the book all through, but the bits I have touched are all wrong. Everyone that I've touched is wrong, and I cannot understand anybody writing like that. And that's why I'm a little against people say, well, why don't you write your life? Why don't you do this, that and the other? I don't believe in it, because I think that the wrong things are always mishandled.
Yes,
Lloyd George did a very great deal.
Mm.
But you don't hear about that. You hear about all about his private
love
life.
Love affairs and things like
love
that.
Love affair.
Yes. Who arranged...
You could have some more of this.
Oh, yes. I'm stopping this, wasn't it? But,
yes.
I mean, did somebody just have the idea of giving it to her in government, or did somebody press for her to have it?
Oh, I don't know exactly how it came about.
Because it's an unusual time. It's 1936, long after the movement's over, isn't it?
And well, when she was, they weren't getting the DBE, were they?
Yes. I mean... No, I don't think they were. I mean, it was presumably it was an honour to women in general that she should be given the DBE. But I wondered whose idea it was, where it came from, you know, because it's rather... Nothing's happening in the women's movement at that time, particularly, at all. But I just don't know the history of it at all.
Well, she was... in the public eye with a lot of people who were not suffrage.
Yes.
I think every one of us felt that she should be given an honour.
Yes. Oh yes, I'm sure you did. But I just wondered why it happened then, you know, and not some other time.
Well, of course, I don't think any... The reason why I think that Christabel has played such an enormous part, I mean, one of the things that indicated, I think, is through the attacks that have been made upon her, the way they've done everything they can to try and drag her down.
Mm.
I mean, there is no doubt to me who did it when they do that.
Why do you think she inspires these attacks? I mean, why do people attack her so much?
Because she hit the nail on the head.
I mean, she looked...
I tell you, she's a person who really brought it away on herself because she was very direct.
Mm.
And you know, there was a comeback.
Mm.
If I wanted to get a thing, I'd go about it in a different way.
She said exactly what she thought.
Yes.
Mm. Mm. Yes. Her mother wasn't like that, was she?
No. Well, her mother had a social background, a social worker's background, and I suppose Christabel was needed. But I do think in a way she brought a tax on herself.
Mm.
through her outspokenness.
Mm. Yes. But still, that's no reason why there should be a tax now from people who didn't suffer from her, is it really?
Well, the militants are very few in number, and they're practically nil today. And there are a great many constitutionals and a lot of liberals, and they don't want what really happened, what really took place, to come out.
Mm. Yes.
And I think one of the books likely to be the most interesting written will be Joe Craigie's.
Yes, Michael Foot's wife.
Mm.
I mean, yes. I'm going to read that article you recommended by her in the New Statesman.
Have you met her?
No, have you met her?
Oh, yes.
Have you? She's working quite hard on it now, is she?
Well, she has to go. She's in her husband's constituency all the weekend, so I think but she's on it. Her book definitely comes out in 1575.
Does it really? Yes. I didn't know that. Oh, that's very good. That'll be very useful, actually. I didn't realise that. Well, you'll need a book in 1775, and she'll give you one, because she's been working longer than I have on it, and will probably do a good job. But Antonia Raeburn's book was well received in the newspapers and so on. It had quite a lot of publicity, didn't it?
Amazing, I think. She had about 65 reviews.
Did she really?
Mm.
Yes, well, that's very good. And the book was quite well produced, wasn't it? It looked quite a nice book, you know, with plenty of illustrations and a good cover. Can I give you some more tea?
No more, thanks. You have some more.
No, I've had enough, thank you. I'll just move this out.
Referee of the juvenile court in Los Angeles, and then later on she was head of the Women's Institute at Framingham, near Boston. And she was a very unusual person. Her great friend, Judge Orford Jean Shantz, was the first referee of the juvenile court in Los Angeles. That was in 1915. And that was a thing that could be willed, and she willed it to her friend Miriam Van Waters. And she was being quite outstanding in the work that she's done for the young people.
She's really a major figure in American juvenile.
And I've been fortunate in having been in touch with a lot of prominent people who've been very worthwhile in that thing.
Mm.
And I look upon Judge Orford Jean Shantz and Miriam Van Waters as two of the most interesting women I've ever met. But there was a good deal of opposition to her.
To Miriam Van Waters.
Because she was trying to go ahead of her time, so to speak, in what she was trying to do.
Mm.
And I was fortunate enough to be trained by her for the work that I did. And then I was field worker, and a part of the time I was in head of the club and the director of field worker, and I had some of her most interesting cases. We had the club itself had about 26 in it all the time, and
you ran the hostel, didn't you?
I ran the yes, and I did a lot of the casework, great deal of casework. I had about over 80 people in the field.
So were you an organizer of people in the field, largely?
Yes. It was one of the most very, very interesting. And then after that I did traveler's aid work in San Francisco. That was very interesting. And from that I went into one thing, or one, they all led out of following the girl, really. I was social work for the dance halls in San Francisco, one of the most interesting jobs I ever had. But I was sort of day and night work. I'd be in the halls until after midnight, get home about 2 o'clock in the morning, and sometimes have to be down in the courts after eight, with a juvenile court or something like that. One very, very interesting.
What do you think made Miriam van Walter's tick, and what drove her on? Was she a very religious person?
Who?
Miriam van Walters.
Oh, I don't know. She was, her father, as a matter of fact, I think was a bishop. But she was she was a very advanced thinker herself. And she was absolutely wrapped up in the problems of the girl problem, as I was in the suffrage.
Yes.
And it was so wonderful that I really enjoyed it as much as I did all the suffrage work that I did. It was fascinating.
What was so fascinating about it?
Well, the cases were so difficult, and I couldn't have had the experience in England that I had then. They were very, very interesting cases. And and I could see the mistakes that were being made and all the rest of it. For instance, she was raising the standard age for them all the time and not allowing them to be thrown into prison. She'd go right over in her car and bring the girl back, and there'd be a row if anything like that happened. So they were very advanced people, and they did wonderful work with their girls.
Did you interview the girls and talk to them about their careers quite a lot then?
Well, I used to have to go and see them and, and all the time find out how they were getting on. And sometimes I remember one girl that had been in there a long time, and Dr. Van Walters was saying that, that she would give up being on probation. The girl looked at me and she says, does that mean that the doctor won't take as much interest in me as she does now? A daughter.
Did they really?
Yes.
Did she do this full time, or was she also?
Oh, she was all the time. She was on she was very wonderful to me, because you see, I was holding a job that anybody who was not a citizen really was not entitled to hold.
She backed you up and sort of prevented.
They wangled it somehow, but I was. Very, very interesting for me.
But you'd never done social work in England, had you? Really?
No, but never. But it was one of the things I wanted to do. I was toying with the idea when I was at the art school. And then I thought, well, what is the good? What is the good of doing this? And suddenly I woke up suddenly to the fact, after knowing about it when I was quite young, I suddenly woke up to the fact that it was hopeless unless we had the vote. And that I was rather disappointed that this thing had got to happen. And I was rather impatient with people who seemed to jog along and think, not with any idea of the thing ending. I wanted a thing, why not now?
So you could then get on with your social work.
I could get on.
Yes, I hadn't realised that. It's very interesting. I hadn't realised that lay behind it so much.
Yes.
What sort of social work, when you were at the art school,
what
sort of social work were you thinking of doing? I mean,
well, I really didn't know, but I was, from a child, I was so upset about poverty or anybody who was, poor and problems of that kind. I was very, very concerned about it, even when I was at school and all the time.
So when the...
I had an idea. I couldn't understand some people being without anything at all and others being very wealthy. And I was very hot on that.
Mm. So when the movement came to an end, you had your chance, really, didn't you?
I had my chance. It was the first time. And I never, it looked as though I wouldn't have the chance, but I had it.
Mm.
It was really wonderful.
You never thought of doing social work in England later, did you?
No. I had a very interesting career and I wouldn't want it any other way. I could not have had it in England, what I had over there.
Because they were more advanced than...
They were much more advanced in America.
Mm. Mm. Yes, I hadn't, that hadn't fallen into place at all in what I was. You said you differed from Sylvia Pankhurst's taste in art. What was your taste then? Your taste, you said, was
well,
sort of Egyptian.
Well, I don't know. The thing was that I thought I was going to be thrown out and said that no good. It was a very interesting Egyptian. And everything I did was Egyptian. It was quite different from the scroll pattern they were doing then. And I didn't appeal to me, the scroll pattern.
So you went on your own line?
I went on my own line because that's what I brought through.
You didn't create it. You
no,
were a mere agent.
No, you don't create anything. Nothing under the sun is new.
Mm.
And in other words, as this teacher said, he said, the best... Cribber is the best designer.
Hmm. So all you've got to do is somehow free your mind in order that inspiration can come in.
Yeah.
Is that right? Yeah. Yes. So were there...
How do you do it?
Well, I don't paint. I'm no good at painting or art or anything like that. I haven't got any skills like that.
No, I mean, how do you get ideas?
Oh, getting ideas. It's very difficult to say, but I suppose, yes, the thing is to try and preserve your childlike attitude on the world, because its children have ideas easily. They're struck by unexpected things, surprising things. Things that happen aren't obviously going to happen to them because they haven't seen them before. And it's really a matter of, to some extent, preserving a childlike attitude into adulthood, isn't it? That's really what creation...
What age children are you teaching?
Well, I'm teaching undergraduates, that is sort of 18 to 21, that sort of age.
Are they interesting?
Oh, yes, they are. But
are all boys?
No, well, mostly young men, yes. But by that age, your inspiration is beginning to vanish away. I mean, unless you've somehow got this ability to preserve your feeling of surprise at how unusual the world is, how surprising it is, you know, unexpected. And some people have this ability and others haven't. Some people are old mentally by the age of 45, and others remain young until they die, you know. I mean, it's a curious thing. But I agree with you. I think it is to some extent a matter of allowing your mind to be struck from outside, you know. But still, I hadn't realised that you were thinking of social work at all. Of course, your grandmother was still alive then, wasn't she? And so you couldn't really think about any career, could you?
No, I mean, I was just... no. And another thing is I really didn't know, you know, because the movement wasn't in being. And I didn't know about this constitutional movement. I didn't run into that at all. And... I just used to nearly burn up, my palms of my hands and my forehead, and it used to get hot and all the rest of it, and I used to walk about wondering what on earth it was, but I knew there was something coming. And mind you, a great many people were like that. I told you this last time.
Yes, one person we didn't discuss last time was Miss Billinghurst. Do you remember her?
I remember Miss Billinghurst,
in a wheelchair.
Yes. She was one of those people that were sort of lifted out of things and able to go on, who was felt very much the same way I did.
Do you remember her at all well, or was she just
a
person
you
saw?
I didn't have time to know many people very well, you know.
No.
But I know of her. I should think she was rather theosophical in her outlook.
Mm. She was certainly
a minister. See, a lot of the speeches that were made by our people were very inspiring speeches. They were more than just fighting for the vote. They went further than that. They were very, very inspiring.
And you think that owes something to theosophy?
And I think that the movement is, I think that period, around that 13-14 period that time, the whole world seemed to be, at least as far as our country was concerned, I know, was going through a great change, and they were unusually inspired at the time. The people that came in were very prominent people. And even those who didn't agree with our militancy, they were very much interested in our people.
Of course, Mrs. Pankhurst herself had been a social worker in a way, hadn't she? She'd been
yes,
a poor law guardian and all that.
Yes. You'll find another thing is very interesting. The background of the women in the constitutional women were like that,
yes,
a great many of them.
They were.
And now you get a person like Cicely Hale, and you'll see from her book that she went right into the way she did into social work.
Yes.
But I don't feel myself that I would have been interested in it over here, because the way I was doing it in America, I had the same freedom that I had in the movement. And if you were capable, you got very great freedom in the movement. I never was stopped in anything that I tried to do.
You weren't organized or disciplined. As long as you did your duty, you obeyed the rules, you were allowed...
Well, you see, some of them got stumped over, you know, they only did part. As I say, sometimes they were all speakers. Other times they had no idea of raising money. And of course then they got into the bad books of the treasurer. And they said they couldn't let you go on unless you could do anything you liked if you raised the money. But I was just one of those fortunate individuals. I raised the money, and it was looked at, they said it was like getting blood out of a stone to get money out of the eastern counties. But I was quite happy about it.
How did you actually raise money? I haven't asked you this. I meant to.
Oh, in all sorts of ways.
How did
I used
you
to make my own appeals on the platform. And, I don't know, we had a campaign all over the country. You know, we had a self-denial week and different things that we did. We had a lot of jumble sales, and I used to get money out of every meeting, I think, almost we ever had.
I'm just really wondering why you were more successful than other people in the movement in raising money. Was it that Irish voice
of
yours?
Well, I think I took it very seriously about the raising of the money.
Yes.
And I think some people didn't take it seriously. They thought it could all come from headquarters, where I realized it was different. And I know that some of the people who came down, they said they never realized before what a lot of responsibility lay with an organizer until they met me. Because I think I must have taken it more seriously.
But did you go around collecting money to wealthy people as individuals,
or
was it at
meetings? At a different time.
At meetings?
I had a method of sending out a circular letter to, say, all my members and friends, sympathizers and all the rest of it, lousy thing. And, of course, a certain number had been answered and checks would come. And I put them all on one side. Then I'd look at my list, go through it with my secretary and say, well, these people, they haven't answered. Send them out another letter. So they sent out another letter. And then sometimes it got to three letters went out. And somebody said something about this. I said, oh, no. They said it was very extravagant the way I did this. I said, not at all. I said, if you'd answered it, I said, you wouldn't have had to send you a second letter. They thought they seemed to be rather keen, interested.
But you start, I'm just trying to get your career clear after you started being an organizer, because you started off in Kensington and West London, didn't you, as an organiser there, really, first. That was your first organising job, wasn't it? And then Shepherd's Bush and that sort of area.
That was my
it?
First one, Shepherd's Bush and Kensington was all one area.
And then then...
Then I went to various, I can't put them in the right order for you.
No,
I was at the Croydon by-election, and I was at Stratford and Avon by-election,
yes.
At Eye in Suffolk, and...
Yes.
Before I was really an organiser.
Yes.
And I did quite a lot of things like that.
And then your grandmother died.
Then I went to different parts of London. I got sent to places where things were going wrong, in other words. Something's wrong, I was sent.
Did you?
Because, you see, I was quite frank about a thing. If I saw a thing, I said so. I didn't care. If they fired me, they fired me. I was absolutely volunteer organiser doing this work. Some of the people were afraid to do it, or some of the people perhaps couldn't see what really was wrong, and I'd find something rather, you know, there, and I'd get it clear. So I went to a lot of places, and then then I was in Brixton, and I was in Brixton for the first election, and then I stayed on for a campaign there. And I think it must have been, my grandmother was living all that time. And it must have been after that, that my grandmother died. And I was asked to go to East Anglia, and I went to Ipswich right away.
And then
I was there until, well, when I said Ipswich, I was all over, you see, after that, Cambridge and all sorts of things came in. By-elections and all sorts of things happened until I was trying to think when I was in Ireland. Oh, I wasn't in Ireland until Mary Lee was arrested and sentenced.
Was that your next job? You finished being organiser in East Anglia?
No, I was still supposed to be the East Anglian organiser, and I'd left secretaries and things there. Although, in a way, I was really beginning to pull out. I can't remember how it was done. It was a very hard time. I had the Bowen Romilly election, and I had the...
That's Lansbury's election,
Lansbury election, that was. And I had followed with the... with Mary Lee in Dublin, and that was a very hard time. I had a lot of terrible Irish crossings. I nearly died one time going over. It was a frightful journey. And then I brought her back. I got a letter from Christabel in which she said I was to leave at once for a vacation and have a complete rest and go to... She got it all fixed up. I was to go to Switzerland. She had to know who I was going to stay with. Well, I didn't do that. But I went to see our solicitor, and I said, well, look, I've got this letter. What am I going to do? How do I handle it? And so he was a very clever man. He defended the Phoenix Park case. And he said, all right. He said, we'll see you. When do you want to go? So I told him, I think I was going the next night. I've got very little time. And I said, I want to take them with me. There were two, Gladys Evans or whatever her name was, and Mary Lee. Mary Lee, of course, was a very difficult person to handle, but she didn't know what went on behind. He said, all right, I'll see it's all right. And so we went over. I didn't know till the last moment whether they were going to be arrested or not. And when we got to London, we just said goodbye, and I went off to Switzerland with my father. I had a very good time, and I saw Christabel with my father in Paris, and Christabel announced that I was going straight to London to understudy Annie.
I see. So that finished your East Anglia thing. Did your father like Christabel when he met her?
Oh yes, he liked her. He was very sympathetic. He was very sympathetic about, thought she must suffer a great deal about Sylvia. He was a thing. Sylvia always seemed to win the hearts of the men. Extraordinary way. She was always weeping. And, he admired Mrs. Pankhurst very much. Of course, they reached the stage where they got so frightened they thought all the leaders ought to be arrested. We didn't agree so well. I never talked about the movement at all. They didn't know what I was doing or where I was going, hardly.
Didn't they really?
Mm.
He It must have been difficult in a way, because you were leading two lives, weren't you?
Yeah, yes, I was.
I mean, you were in the movement, but you couldn't talk about that
life
in your family circle, could you?
No.
Was it embarrassing? I mean, did they expect you?
Well, they didn't get anything from me. I was a very independent person. I think they used to be worried at times, you know, wondering what was happening.
Yes, yes. Well, when you were in prison, for instance, did they know you were in prison?
Yes. My father came to see me.
Did he?
Yeah. Louis Hatfield was with him. And my people, when they knew I was in and I was being arrested, my great friend, very close friend, and Honorary Secretary in Ipswich, he came straight up to London and stayed with my father, took him round. And he had to have a bad time for a long time, because, you see, I had to write a note when they arrested all the heads in 13. I wrote a note to say, whatever you do, don't try and get in touch with me. And my people, without my asking them, they were wonderful.
Your brothers as well?
Oh, my brother was wonderful. My eldest brother was in Canada, but my young brother, he was a student, a medical student. He was in the court when they sentenced me. But there were no women.
It excluded the women.
Something rather happened and they turned them all out.
Mm. So you really had sort of full family backing all the way through your biggest crisis.
They were very horrified and very upset about the forcible feeding, and they were very alarmed when every time I got arrested and then somehow or other I got off. But I had the backing of my family, and I had a good deal of sympathy from aunts and people like that. My great aunt, she was rather one of the old-fashioned sort of black Protestants that they call them in Ireland, and she sat down and wrote terrific letters to the members of Parliament on the subject.
It's awfully difficult, because you couldn't go home, could you? I mean, when you were out of prison, you couldn't go home, could you? I mean, you had to keep away from your home.
I had to be away from my home a great deal, you see. I had to be very, very careful.
Mm.
You see, I went back with a warrant out for my arrest. I went back and all 1914, the greater part of 1913, the latter part, I was in the office all the time. And every now and again they would come and say, somebody come and, Inspector so-and-so is outside. And that meant danger of arrest. So I used to say, I put on my wings of darkness. I was always acting and things. So a long time when it was all over and the war was on, and I was very good friends with all these people going back and forth between London and Paris. He said, you know, he said, anybody seen Grace Rowe? They used to say, and they were sitting on packing cases and things like that. Anybody know what Grace Rowe looks like? I said, some people said you were short, other people said you were tall, but you'll never be able to get away again. I said, I don't have to. And another thing they told me was that about the men that got sent to the front that arrested me. And they said, you know, they were absolutely terrified of you when I was being taken in a taxi from Lincoln's Inn House to Cannon Row, wherever it was. And I said, well, what are they afraid of me for? He said, well, he said, you know, you never spoke a word the whole time. He said, they were absolutely terrified. I didn't. I never opened my mouth the whole time I was there. It's funny what frightens people, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I mean, complete silence is, in some ways, much more frightening than talking. Yes. But I suppose you didn't want to talk, partly because you were probably worried and tired.
I didn't, and I had nothing to say to them at all, and I realized, thought it was very dangerous in any way.
Mm. Mm. So, that's interesting. One thing that does strike me throughout your life, Miss Rowe, is that, I mean, I made a note actually when I'd read when I heard the last tape, you've got a you acquire at different periods in your life very close attachments to a number of women, to your mother first of all, then to your grandmother, and then to Christabel Pankhurst, and then to Dr. Walters, and then to Mrs. Gray, and Miss and Clara Codd as well, and you become so attached to them that you say that you people even say you speak like them, and you become to resemble them in a way when you're when you're attached to them. How can you explain that sort of quality? I mean, it's not just Christabel, is it?
Well, I tell you, I think it is. Well, I feel one with it, one with them, and they are at that particular period doing the things that, or thinking the things, or doing the things that I am interested in.
Yes, I mean, you have a capacity for completely identifying with.
I can
people.
Identify myself with anybody that I've got to.
I mean, not many
people
can do that.
And yet, I think people think that I'm rather standoffish.
I haven't found
and
that.
And they also think that I won't see anybody, I won't let anybody interview me.
Well, it certainly hasn't been the case with you, with me, anyway. And you've been most helpful with me. But not many people have that ability to identify their own careers with somebody else's like that. Do you see what I mean? A number of points.
I don't know.
It's most unusual sort of career, and Christabel is only one of many, or one of seven or eight people
that I've been very closely identified with.
Yes, yes. But
of course, it depends on what is happening.
Yes, yes.
And I think that, in a way, I've had a lot of interest in this way. Nearly everybody went out of my life at the time of the end of, well, my school friends practically went out with about one. And the art school that I was with, I knew everyone in the school, and they all went out, and perhaps only one would be left behind, if that. And everything I did, as the thing was ending, for instance, I had no comeback on a single case when I left my job in San Francisco. And they all go right out, and then I go into another group.
It's as though a page has been turned over,
yes.
Sort of thing. Yes.
I don't know, I suppose other people's lives, everybody's life is different.
Yes.
But it's been like that with me.
But of course, what I'm saying isn't quite right, because you retained your connection with Christabel Pankhurst.
Oh, I didn't lose my connection. No,
after you attached yourself to Mrs. Van Walters.
Yes.
So, I mean, it doesn't quite work like that in that case, does it?
No.
But in some of the others, I mean, you know, you seem to give all your loyalty to one person, and then they die, or you move away, or something like that, and then you find another person, and so on. It's unusual. I mean, I really ask you about that because I'm not like that at all. I don't find myself identifying with other people in the same way at all. I rather wish I did, but. You must be conscious of it yourself.
Well, I don't know why it's like that. It's just
because, I mean, it's unusual, really. Because you are, as you yourself say, you're a bit of a rebel. I mean, you're not. It's not as though you're not independent.
Oh.
You are independent, aren't you?
Yeah.
And yet you can. Deny yourself or identify yourself completely with other people. It's an unusual sort of combination, isn't it?
Well, I think it's very, very necessary, and I don't think that the movement, we'd have come through the movement if it hadn't been for this identification of a group. And when that when the thing ends, it ends. I think that. People like to make a mystery out of all these things, but whatever was happening with the Pethick Lawrences and the Pankhursts, that time had come for them to part. And if it hadn't come then, when it did, it would have come in 1914, because Pethick Lawrence was a pacifist, and His thing would have ended at a later date. That is all as far as I can see.
Yes, yes. Because Mrs. Pankhurst had never been a pacifist.
No, Mrs. Pankhurst, she said, what's the good of fighting for a vote if you haven't got a country to vote in? Bingo, she was right off to tell everybody to go out and do what
yes.
they could.
Did she make the decision that easily? I mean,
very quickly, I mean to say...
Because you were there, weren't you, when she made that decision, really, weren't you, at St. Malo?
Well, I stayed in St. Malo.
And did she sort of come out with it like that?
She came right out with it, yes.
Did
and
she?
I mean, it's in all her early talks. And I thought when I was going back in the 10th of September when Christabel spoke, I thought I was going to hear a most marvellous waiting to hear what Christabel was going to say. I found that every single word that she said in the meeting I'd already heard from her, and there was nothing new for me at all.
But from her, not from Mrs. Pankhurst. I mean, whose idea was it that the women's movement should completely change direction and go for recruiting and supporting the war effort?
Well, Mrs. Pankhurst, you see, said, go on, what's the good of fighting for a country if you haven't got a country to vote in? Let me see now, what is it you wanted me to say?
Well, I was wondering whether it was Christabel who first caused this change of direction, or whether it was Mrs. Pankhurst who really...
Well, I think it came directly from Mrs. Pankhurst, the change.
Did it?
First of all, you see, the thought was that it was going to be a short war. And Christabel protected us right away by sending Annie, and later on Jessie, and she herself, and Olive Bartels went with her. They were all out of the country, because they didn't know what was going to happen, and they couldn't be arrested over there, you see. Whereas Mrs. Pankhurst and I were in London. But it was all very, very carefully thought out. I mean, the day I came out, the first thing I heard from Annie, who came down from Scotland the night that I was released, she told me that she'd already had instructions from Christabel to not to tell anyone, but she was to go to America immediately. And what happened was that she did that in the very beginning. But when I got out there, hadn't been out there about 2 weeks, I suppose, when a solicitor, a friend of Mrs. Tuke's, came over, and he must have given them information at that point, saying that it is not going to be a short war, it's going to be a long war. And then that was when she decided to come back.
You were released from prison after the war broke out, were you?
Yes, the 10th of August.
And you went straight to St. Malo?
No, I was a week in a nursing home.
Oh, were you?
And then my understudy, the girl that I, woman rather, dear, I think it would be nice for you to see, she went over with me, yes.
Yes, I see. Yes. What sort of place was Christabel living in Paris when you went over there? You went over
very
there a lot.
Very nice flat.
Was it?
A very nice flat, yes.
Yes. Sort of, was it like it was in Shoulder to Shoulder, with sort of long curtains and tall windows?
Nothing like it at all.
What was it like?
I mean, made up.
What was it like really then?
Well, it was, I don't know, there were... She had a very nice sitting room and a bedroom, and then off was through glass doors you could open, there was a dining room with a little sort of sofa on, and whenever I came I used to sleep on this sofa, and Christabel had a very nice bedroom, and in this living room the mantelpiece was always covered, it hadn't an ornament on it of any kind, it just had lots of cuttings all along, and then one end it had a picture of Joan of Arc, and there was in the room on the other side was bookshelves filled with books, most of them from the London Library, and then behind at the end of the room there was a door, and then at the end of the room there was a screen. And behind the screen there were newspapers piled up as high as ever you could go. When Christopher was writing a book, her article, she'd say, "I want to know what's that sort of thing." And you dived into this thing and pulled something or other out in the middle and brought it over to her if you were lucky.
Did she have a secretary there?
She had secretaries at different times, different people.
English women?
Yes.
Yes. Who would be sent from headquarters to be her secretary?
Yes. But...
That's a very vivid description, a beautiful description.
Of what?
Of the flat. I mean, I didn't... See, you say you haven't got a good memory. I mean, that's a marvellous description. Can you remember anything else about, you know, what the pictures were on the wall and
I don't think she had any pictures on the wall at all. I don't think there was much wall to have pictures on, because right across the wall, and then the windows, you see, then right across the, say the windows were here, right across the opposite were right up to the ceiling, and it was filled with books. And then there was a door, which was a glass door, and you went through and you were in the dinette. And I remember that there was the table there, and the telephone was just behind. Get it a minute.
Did she cook?
No. Goodness, no. She didn't have time for anything.
Who did cook then for?
We had a French maid.
And she ate meals there?
She was on the other side afterwards. She wasn't there, but she had a similar flat later on. But we think of her mostly as the one at the Arc de Triomphe, the first one she was in. But they were all very much of the same nature, and not very, very different. She used to want books and books and books. And I used to arrive, and you know the suitcases. I think I told you this, didn't I?
I think you did.
They were so heavy, and the people used to look at ask us at the fact the books were a lot of German names on them.
These were books for her article
for her to read.
On the Great Scourge.
A terrific reader.
Yes.
I never seen anything like it.
Did she read by herself in a study, or did she read in company? I mean.
Oh, she read at any time.
She just sort of could concentrate, even with all this going on around her.
She was extraordinary. I remember that they say that when she was in Manchester, Annie Kenny told me that she'd sit on a sill in the window, and she'd study for her LLB, and she'd munch cherries. She loved cherries, and she just ate cherries and everything there. And the whole family would be in the other side of the curtain, making up the most terrific row. And she didn't mean anything to her at all. She was quite unconscious of it all. I marvel at that.
So do I. I can't do that myself.
I mean, I can't understand how these youngsters now, they find it much easier to study if they have the television going, or the radio going. You've got to have noise all around them. I can't understand it.
No, I can't either. But
and I'm not at all sure that it's not shutting something out.
Mm.
Doing that. What do you think?
Yes. On the other hand, if you can only work in silence, it's so difficult to get silence nowadays that you get distracted by noises. So maybe it's a good idea to have noise all the time, and then you don't get those distractions. It's difficult, isn't it? I don't know. I prefer to work in the quiet myself.
Well, I like to have... I've more or less always lived it when I was at home. I couldn't go down very often, but when I did go down, I had a room at the top of the house, and I had it all in the colours. the carpet was green, and the chintz was purple, white, with purple and green in it, and I had about 11 photographs of Christabel and several of the leaders, other leaders, and a very nice open fire was always there, and there was no telephone in those days, so you sent a telegram saying you were coming down, and I'd get down very late at night, and there would be sandwiches and everything on the kettle on the hob, and I used to make my decisions like that when it was very, very quiet.
Was this when you were in Earl's, was it Earl's Court where you were in, when you were underground?
No, that wasn't when I was underground. That was before I reached that stage at all.
Oh, I see. Yeah. What, at Norwood, you mean, when you were at home?
Yes.
Oh, I see. You had your room in your, at home in the colours.
Yes, yes.
Did you really? Goodness.
And I got there very seldom. But it was always very important to me to go to this one spot and have the quiet around me and everything to make a certain decision.
I agree, yes, I would be like that, I think, too. But when you went to prison, presumably some of your friends knew you'd gone to prison, did they cut you or break contact with you?
Nobody broke contact with me.
Nobody?
In fact, some people who had not approved of anything that I was doing at all wrote a wonderful letter saying, though they didn't agree, they admired me so much what I'd done.
Mm. So you didn't suffer socially at all?
No, I didn't seem to suffer in any way about anything like that.
Because you told me last time how your people came to your grandmother and said what you were doing.
Yeah, oh yes, she was lovely. Oh,
yes, so obviously they, in a way, they were trying to bring pressure on you at that stage, but that was much earlier, wasn't it?
They didn't get any sympathy from my grandmother.
No, no, precisely.
No, I had a very, very, I've had a very easy life, in a way.
Well, I wouldn't exactly call it that. but still, I mean...
And I never bothered about these people that disliked me, who turned against me, and I don't know what they thought about me, what I'd done wrong, I don't know, but didn't matter in the very least. Really was like water off a duck's back. I didn't care at all.
As Mrs. Pankhurst said to you.
Yes. But the latter part of the movement, I think, was more united than anything almost could be. I think there was a terrific understanding between us all. And we knew how to give and take and, you know, act, when to act and when not to act. And a wonderful group.
Like a sort of second sight,
yes,
in a way.
Yes. Mm. Seven of us, I had to get them out of government jobs for the munitions procession. We were there, just seven of us. We only met twice when I go to some of these committee meetings and they go on for hours and they decide nothing. I had two meetings with a whole lot, one at the outset and one at the end, and the whole thing went like clockwork.
Well, you've been trained up in the movement by that time, hadn't you, to do things efficiently?
Yeah, yeah.
Yes. Did it ever occur to you to argue with Christabel or with Mrs. Pankhurst about policy? Did you ever discuss policy with her, or did you feel it was your position to accept orders?
No, I came in for quite a lot because, especially in the war, I used to go with Annie for interviews because Christabel was always afraid of, you know, saying that she'd said something other that she hadn't said, and she, you know, it was better for the witness to be there. And I would be there very quiet, watching. I remember she was interviewing a very, a diplomat, great importance, you'd know his name if I told you. And I watched him the whole time. And everything he was saying was what Christabel would like him to say. But I knew he was lying. And I had quite a time over that over again. I said, I know it's what you want said. But he didn't believe what he said. And sometimes I could see through their eyes, and sometimes it was the mouth, but I could hear, and I used to watch things like that very closely. And so I was in touch with Christabel about a lot of things. She and I could be very, very frank with Christabel.
Mm. And you were always prepared to do what she wanted you to do in the end.
Yes, but I'd warn her, and one time I warned her about something, and she was very much wanted it to come out the way she wanted it. She'd actually written an article about the thing. And we'd gone to press, and suddenly word came into me. And very few people would have dared do this. I killed the article. I've got something else to put it in. But I stopped it, but not in time to get some galleys had gone out and they'd got into the Yorkshire Post. And the next morning, of course, there was nothing in the. Fortunately, there was nothing in the paper because it had been very damaging, and the only thing that appeared in, of course, it wasn't there. They couldn't do a thing.
So you could take the initiative.
I took a thing. Christabel once said to somebody about me, she said, what was how she put it? She's the only organizer I have who knows when to disobey an order. That's the second compliment.
The first one was you're the most...
The first one was Mrs. Pankhurst, and the other one was Christabel.
yes. Well, that's interesting. But I mean, you quite often had discussions
with a two-way argument. Well, Christabel said of Annie and myself that we, when it came to defending ourselves, she said, you're the worst people, you have no idea how to defend yourselves at all, she used to say.
You mean in argument?
Yes, in argument. She had no idea how to defend yourself.
Because she was very powerful in argument, wasn't she?
Yes. She was very powerful. And she'd say, oh, now I don't want you to work with so-and-so. And think, oh, but Christabel so-and-so is such using. And he knows all the rest of it. No, I don't want it. Annie and I would win out. We'd win out, and surely it failed every time. It was most extraordinary. Christabel was very uncanny about things like that.
Were people in the WSPU frightened of her in the sense that they would be terrified of offending her or doing anything wrong?
I don't think so. But not in that way.
They wanted to please her, presumably, didn't they?
Some people, you know, are afraid, aren't they, of saying it to anybody.
Yes.
I think on the whole, the suffragettes were pretty outspoken.
Mm.
But I don't know anybody who would have, done what I did, and thank goodness I was there to do it.
Mm. You mean to warn her in particular moment?
To have smashed a thing like that without no way of getting through to her that she was in war.
Mm. Mm.
It lasts a very 11th hour.
Yes,
Didn't take time to say, I think about it.
I quite agree, yes. Did she have any French friends much when she was in France?
She had some very good French friends, yes.
Did she?
Not a lot, you know.
Mm.
I don't think she was interested in anybody who had some connection with the whatever she was doing.
The women's movement in some way.
Yeah.
Mm. But she went out with French friends
when
she was there.
She was so delightful, I mean to say. And she would always leave everybody thinking they were the only one. Mrs. Pankhurst had that great gift too. She always make everybody feel that they were the one. They were very, very clever. I'd like to be able to do that.
It's a sort of rather subtle flattery, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes. There was one thing Mrs. Pankhurst said that you told me about last time. I didn't quite understand what you meant. You were talking about the YHBs in the Strand.
About the what?
The YHBs in the Strand. When you went in once a week or something to the Strand, to that restaurant.
Oh, the Strand, yes.
Yes. And you said Annie Kenny introduced you to her.
Not Annie, Jessie.
Jessie Kenny.
Jessie.
Introduced you to
Jessie
her.
Jessie was in the office and a very great deal in the next room to Christabel and used to, you know, be sort of acting as her secretary. And she used to, Jessie in the early days was quite remarkable. She was so clever with all the men. She got the stewards to be thrown out of the cabinet ministers' meetings, and she had a code name for all these cabinet ministers and all the rest of it. Jessie was very good at that kind of thing. She played quite a part. But she was with Christabel quite a lot in Paris. But on the whole, she had pretty bad health, and she'd be out of the thing for a long time. She got over it in later years, but she had TB.
But she...
She's first, very good brain.
She first introduced you to Mrs. Pankhurst in the Strand, didn't
well,
she?
She was at this meeting, you see, that we had, and she, I had only seen Mrs. Pankhurst on the Hyde Park platform, and I hadn't seen her at all or heard her speak or anything else. And she came in, and Jessie brought me up and said, "This is Grace Rowan. She'd be prepared to go to prison later on." Mrs. Pankhurst froze. Because you see, Mrs. Pankhurst would never lend any influence. She'd leave it entirely to anybody to do what they believed to be right. She wouldn't want to do anything that would seem to be encouraging them to do a thing.
I see.
You see my point?
Yes. In other words, she's trying to make you say you want to go to prison, really, rather than that she should press you into it.
Yes, she wouldn't. She didn't press people. Some people did. I mean, they went and made great appeals, but Mrs. Pankhurst was different.
She believed it should come from inside you.
Inside the person.
Yes.
And it's very much safer, because then, the other way they might not be able to go through with it.
Yes. Because, of course, when you went to, not Lincoln's Inn, the earlier place.
Clements Inn.
Clements Inn. When you first went there, you described that last time, and how they got you into the office and sat each side of you and said, "Are you prepared to go to prison?"
That was Jessie again.
Jessie
again,
wasn't
you see.
Yeah.
Now, she, what I would call, blunder in on things like that. And what I noticed was some of these younger ones, and had a different type of bringing up to what I'd had myself, that they were very inclined to throw the blame on somebody else. And they couldn't understand me, because I said, "Well, if I'm responsible for anything goes wrong, I am responsible. It's happened. And I must take the responsibility of it." They couldn't understand that. They'd say, "Oh, you should be very careful." And they should put it on. So I said, "No, not on your life, I wouldn't do it." I learnt a lot about, you know, people's different standards.
Yes, yes. You said Mrs. Pankhurst had a bodyguard later on
when she got the 3 years penal servitude. From that time on, you see, we got her away from one place to another, and then we formed a bodyguard. They really protected Mrs. Pankhurst and Annie Kenney. And really the funny thing was that there was I in a time when there was a warrant out for my arrest, and Annie would want me close to her when she was going into a meeting, and I'd have a doctor there and everything, and doing the whole thing. The only thing that saved me was my hat.
Which had it?
Yeah.
Yes. But I mean, who were in the bodyguard then? Was it a small group, or what?
One of the people who really was cleverest at it was Olive Bartels, my understudy.
I must meet her.
She's worth meeting.
I'd love to meet her.
And Harding, who you wouldn't be able to meet now, she's in Canada. But Olive Bartels would give you a very good idea.
I'd love to talk about that.
First of all, you know, it was terrific, and they used to come down to my flat. I was in hiding then, and they used to come in and all sit round and decide what was going to do and how it was going to be done. And then finally, I remember at the end, they said, "Well, how are we to know what time we're to do this, make this move?" And I looked and I said, I gave a time by the clock. And do you know, at that exact moment, they all came back to tell me what that is. She got away. They came back the next day, and I remember there was an older woman who had a car and a chauffeur, and she was the one who was got to get off with this particular car. She said, "Absolutely, he nearly ran over somebody. We went to the minute."
But how many were in the bodyguard, roughly, for the two women?
We had quite a lot afterwards.
At any one time, would there be three or four for each person?
Many more.
Oh, I see.
You'd have all placed at doing different things.
Yes.
Coming out of a meeting, they'd all be there.
Yes.
And,
but it was one group of people
who were known as a special group.
Were they young ones or big ones or?
Some of them were older and some of them were very young.
Yes. But were they strong ones? I mean, how were they selected, really?
Well, their courage and their capacity to be able to, you know, act quickly.
Yes, yes.
And we sort of knew our people.
Yes.
And they had to be called out at a moment's notice and not tell anybody.
And they'd just go round with Annie or with Mrs. Pankhurst?
Oh, well, there was a whole plan made, I mean to say, of how they got away, how to get them out of the house, how perhaps to get them over a wall and into another house and out another door. And somebody else would address as Mrs. Pankhurst, and the people would think they'd got Mrs. Pankhurst, they hadn't got her at all. In the meantime, Mrs. Pankhurst was whisked away by another door, all that kind of thing.
Mm.
And you'd find that the house would be surrounded, Mouse Castle would be surrounded by detectives all the time. But when it comes to the early hours of the morning, they got very sleepy. There was a certain time when you could watch when it was the time to get away with them. It was all very carefully planned, and Oliver Tales was right in it. And I had to do the thing more behind the scenes. But I knew very quickly exactly when Mrs. Pankhurst had got off and changed into another car and was on her way. I'd know. We had a code all the time. We used to be quick at our codes. We never even wrote them down.
You had nicknames, didn't you? You called each other nicknames quite a lot, didn't you?
Well, we had pseudo names, yes.
Yes. I mean, for instance, there's one called Pansy, isn't there? Now, who was Pansy?
Pansy was Mrs. Tuke.
That's right, yes. I thought she was.
She had eyes like pansies. We called her Pansy.
I see, yes. Didn't
we, what?
We haven't talked about her at all, have we? She was prominent in the office, wasn't she?
Well, she was a very charming person. And she came from South Africa, and she was a friend of the Betty Lawrence's. And she became devoted to Christabel and her mother. And she used to be in the office and, you know, meet people. She was quite social. Dictate some of the sort of social letters and that sort of thing. But she was rather highly nervous. And every now and again, Christabel would say, would you like me to have Pansy over here? And I'd say, yes.
What would happen then?
Well, she'd go over there, I mean, say, we were ever going to do something or other that, you know, we wouldn't want anybody to come and warn us or tell us. You know, she'd be nervous about things. But she was a lovely person. She died when she was about 93. I saw quite a lot of her in the latter years.
She went away on a tour of South Africa or something, didn't she, just before the war?
She went to South Africa and then she'd left South Africa. She decided with all that was going on she didn't want to stay.
I see.
She wanted to be there because her husband died there, but she came back. She decided that she didn't want to stay.
When did she come back, do you know, roughly?
No, I'm afraid I don't quite know when she came back.
But she settled in England in the end, did she?
Yes, she settled in England. She was with a nephew or something when she died. And she was in and out of nursing homes and not at all strong.
Yes. Did she have a job after she left the suffragette movement?
No,
she had her own money,
yes,
didn't she?
Yes, she had her own money.
Yes, yes.
Not a lot, you know. There's one thing about the suffragettes, they none of them had much money. Just enough to get on with, no more.
Mm.
And sometimes it was hard going.
Mm.
But,
yes, one of the interesting things is that this is a period when everybody has domestic servants, isn't it? So that you're freed from household bother.
Yeah.
To get on with suffragette work.
Yeah.
So in a way the working women are helping in an indirect sort of way, aren't they?
Yes, they are, very much so.
Because as you say, Christabel didn't do her own cooking. A working woman did, a French woman.
Mrs. Pankhurst was looked after by Nurse Pine all the time.
Yes.
If there wasn't anybody else in the place doing the cooking, Nurse Pine would be there to do it. Well, she was with her all the time.
I don't know much about Nurse Pine. What was she?
She was a St. Bartholomew's nurse.
Was she?
And she was very clever, very amusing, and very very good nurse. I mean, very friendly, and at the same time she got what she wanted done. And she was devoted to Mrs. Pankhurst, absolutely. And
so she'd take her over.
You see, they had a nursing home. She and I can't remember the name of her friend now. Mrs. Pankhurst would be in the nursing home a great deal.
That was in Pembridge Square.
Yes.
My mother lives in Pembridge Place, actually.
Did she hear much about them?
No. Oh no. My mother's much younger. I mean, she's about 20 years older than I am. She's about getting on for 60 now.
Yeah.
So it's long before her time, but I know Pembridge Square quite well.
Yeah.
But Nurse Prime was a private nurse, really, was she? Not a hospital nurse.
She was absolutely private. I mean, she was just devoted to the Pankhurst and the movement, and she was wonderful.
Mm. Did she carry on being a nurse after the end of the movement?
No, she went away with Mrs. Pankhurst to Canada.
Did she?
Yes.
Of course, Mrs. Pankhurst had that business with the babies, the war babies,
yes,
didn't she?
Yes. She had two of the war babies with her, and Christopher had one.
Yes, I completely forgotten about that. So she stayed with Mrs. Pankhurst in Canada. Did she come back with Mrs. Pankhurst afterwards? Or?
Yes, I don't quite know what happened in the end. She died.
Did she?
Yes. And
because she was obviously a key person.
Oh, absolute treasure. Mm. And of course, many of us were in. Mary Richardson was in there, and I was there. Quite a number of us were there, looked after by Nurse Prime.
One very interesting document I came across in Harvard in America. It's the documents that the police took from the WSPU headquarters in 1913. And there's quite a lot of correspondence and notes that Christabel sent from Paris to the headquarters. And there are lots of references to...
Headquarters where?
To the headquarters in London.
Yes.
And there are lots of references to Pansy and to the various suffrage people with their nicknames. And Pansy's the only one I can remember, but there are others I can't remember now. I wish I had it with me now, and I'd read bits of it.
Mine was Courtney.
Yes, I don't remember Courtney being mentioned in this correspondence. But Pansy was certainly one.
We had a whole lot of names for all the cabinet ministers.
Did you?
Yes.
I suppose that was just to make sure that you weren't...
I couldn't remember all of them now, but at different times we had names. Christopher and I carried on.
Yes.
With the nicknames. Very few people have understood our letters.
Yes. Well, that's why I mentioned it, because a lot of these things that Christabel says in her letters from Paris, it's difficult for me to understand because they're all in code or all using nicknames, like that. I wish I could... I'll look it up when I get home, and I'll give you some other nicknames if I've got any written down, and you can tell you who they are.
Yeah.
And what's
and there. Who did this go to?
Well, this went to the police, you see, and it was part of the government case against the WSPU that was being worked up. And there are about 100 pages of foolscap legal documents quoting all these letters, you see. And they're in the women's library in Harvard University.
Really?
And I've never seen them anywhere else. I haven't seen them in the Fawcett Library, and they're not in the London Library either. I don't know why.
Could there be in a copy?
They are a copy. It's a carbon copy or a sort of duplicated copy.
Yeah.
So there must have been other copies somewhere, but I don't know where they are.
I'd be very interested in that.
I'll hunt it out.
1913.
Yes, I'll hunt it out. I'll make a note to do that because otherwise I might forget. I'll write you a letter telling you what's in it. Would you like to hear yourself?
Yes, please.
All right.